Order, 23rd of September 2014. We have present Councilwoman Kilpatrick, Councilman Sheldon, Councilman Tackett, Councilman Bell, Councilmember Street, Councilmember Weiner, Councilmember Smalley, Councilmember Cartier, Councilwoman Diller, and Councilman Retta. This is my legislative aide, Nikai Trailer, and I'm Councilman Hollings. We'll have the adoption of the minutes from the meeting of the, when's the last meeting? May 27th.
Motion approved.
Second.
Second. All in favor?
Aye.
Thank you very much. The minutes of the meeting from May 27th have been adopted. We have, at the beginning of our agenda for today, we have four items to be discussed here in community services that we would normally discuss in finance, but since this meeting was scheduled for today, we will briefly discuss these items first. I will be sponsoring the first two items on this agenda at the meeting, and Councilwoman Diller will be sponsoring the second two items on this agenda. The first two items has to do with the realignment of neighborhood stabilization programs. Both resolution number 14091 and ordinance number 14092, both are realigning neighborhood stabilization program income. Is there any questions from members of council with regard to these two items? Seeing none, Councilmember Diller, if you would take the next two.
Yes. If you look at 14-093, this is a very similar ordinance as the two before, appropriating funds and also anticipated program income to the Neighborhood Stabilization Program. But this is NSP3, so it has slightly different zip codes. But basically, the process is the same.
Thank you. And you have one more.
Yes. Ordinance number 14-094. This is reallocating funds from the department, from the Delaware Division of Libraries to our libraries, of course, administered through our Department of Community Services.
Any comments or questions on either? Seeing none, no comment or questions on the legislation from the council members. Any comment or questions from the public on legislation that we're planning to adopt later on today? Seeing none, we'll move to the other couple items on the agenda. We have two presentations today. One is the Route 9 Library presentation, and that will be followed by the Workforce Housing Annual Report. Dinah Brown will be presenting on the Route 9 Library presentation. I'm sure most council members are aware of what's happening at Route 9 with the new library and the Innovation Center, and you've gotten some communications as well about a new designation, perhaps, that requires state approval to do even more of what was originally planned at the site on Route 9. With no questions, I will yield to Ms. Brown for the presentation on the Route 9 library.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon. This is very much a group project, so I would like to acknowledge my general manager, Cynthia Hansen, and our fiscal person, Eileen Latham, and our two colleagues from Special Services, Marion Doherty and Steve Rubel. We have really come a long way since we last talked about this project in the spring. And just to kind of bring you up to date before we get into the site tours, I want to talk a little bit about the needs assessments. There was an assessment that was done in March of 2013 by a nationally known consultant, Himmel & Wilson. We did present that to you, and at the time, that led us to move forward with planning for a library to serve this area. Next slide. That original needs assessment was for a relatively small building, a 15,000 square foot building. And once we got into the project and we looked at the demographics, in fact, I can remember when Councilman Street asked me about 15,000 square feet, we said we were gonna go back and look at the square footage again, because we didn't really factor in technology and we didn't factor in a lot of the current trends. So we did that with Carson Block, who's also done some work for the state libraries. And what he helped us identify were 7 focus areas that we really wanted to look at that were beyond the traditional library with books in them. So this is the area that we looked at. This is the service area. You'll see there's a little, about a third down, there's a little arrow showing the site of the proposed library. And what you will be getting, in fact, we have a copy of the resolution for you if you haven't gotten it already. But at the October 14th meeting, we're going to ask to have a vote, is that right? On 3 parcels of land that total 12 acres. If you're familiar with where Bolarama is, it's approximately right across the street from there. And we've gone through the due diligence with the environmentals and all of that, so we're moving forward on the pledges.
Can I ask a question?
Sure, go ahead.
While we're on this, the study, from day one I asked, when the needs assessment and everything was done, that they take a look at what the impact would be on the Wilmington Library and the Newcastle City Library. Was that part of that study?
When you say impact, I think I'm not exactly sure what you mean by impact. Would we take away users from those libraries?
Yeah, and what would be the effect?
And I would say no. I would say the Wilmington Library is right now primarily servicing residents of the inner city of Wilmington. And the Newcastle Library is primarily serving residents of Newcastle. It has limited parking, and it is drawing from a certain area, but we really don't see this library interfering with either one of those operations.
I know we're the forgotten stepchild, but the Basin Road Corridor, Jefferson Farms, Van Dyke Village, Van Dyke Village, Swanwick Estates, Castle Hills, all of those communities use the Newcastle City Library, as well as traveling to Bear, but most of them do use the Newcastle City Library for what they need.
Well,
so it sounds like that wasn't even taken into consideration.
Well, one of the things that might surprise you is that we have actually done studies that shows usage of libraries, and what we find is that many, many users use multiple libraries. We did actually a study using library barcodes about 5 or 6 years ago, and I can share that with you, but it showed through little pinpoints the address of every single user. And so what we see is, for example, the Claymont and Brandy 100 libraries, there are a lot of people who use both of those, and that's true for Wilmington. There are a lot of people who use the Wilmington Library, also use Brandy 100 Library. It just depends on where they are in any given day. So the original needs assessment showed square miles around Newcastle and around Wilmington, and showed that there was actually a gap area that was not being served.
Give you an idea of a missing demographic. I never had a library card. I took my daughter down to Newcastle to do her studies in the library. Didn't check books out, so I wouldn't show in that demographic. So my asked and answered. It was not part of this study, though it was asked numerous times. So,
The timeline. We are on a very aggressive timeline. We hope to be able to have a groundbreaking, I would say probably in the spring of this year.
Wow.
And then with an expected opening date of winter 2016. So we're moving pretty quickly. Now I want to shift the focus to what we were asked to do, which is basically, rather than hiring outside consultants for this piece, to use the strength of our current library managers, who have a lot of education, a lot of experience, to go out and make site visits. And not just observe, but also establish connections so that as we build services, we will have these connections with people to help us on our way. The 7 focus areas that have been identified were mentoring programs, and again, these are things that are beyond the typical library with just books in it. Mentoring programs, education technology programs, skill building programs, early literacy and parenting, neighborhood economic development, special needs, and special collections. So the teams that went out and made their site visits were looking at these particular areas. In terms of mentoring programs, what they were looking at is spaces and programs that were dedicated to mentoring, and looking at things that were offering collaborative spaces for all age groups, not just any given age group.
Mr. Chairman, I just want to make a comment. And I'm glad, you know, we're having a review of these types of functions in this proposed new facility. I can tell you from the grant writing experience for Claymont Library, a lot of the funders of grants like this like to see the enhanced programming, that libraries are simply not a place where people go check out library books and sit around and read and leave, so that we offer a suite of services around the library function to enhance the quality and the enrichment of the experience. So I think this is really useful for council to know this.
And it's certainly what we've seen nationally. So if you go to, these are five photos from five different libraries. We had two librarians go to Colorado, and they visited 12 libraries in five different library systems. Can you go back? And what you'll see is a variation of the concept of working together. The Highlands Ranch, they had, that was kind of an adult area. The Castle Rock had the higher table with the higher chairs to attract teens. Arapahoe County had movable tables and chairs, a larger space in Pennsylvania, and then also in Castle Rock. And a lot of what you see is flexible space and flexible furniture. Again, these are two additional sites in Chicago. We had the Bear Library Manager went to Chicago. Chicago is starting to be known internationally for the services that they provide, and they're part of the Gates Global Library Initiative. So they were a library that we wanted to really pay attention to. What you're seeing more and more in libraries are what's called makerspaces. And what a makerspace is, it allows users to actually create something. It could be a video, it could be music. And this is an entrance to a studio in Colorado, and you'll see the green wall behind it, which allows you to film. Another program that we saw that is very exciting to us is in Brooklyn. And what they've done is, with a $170,000 grant, they recruit 80 students a year. And they train them with computer skills, not just how to use computers, but how to fix them. They have 32 hours of mandatory training, and then they are required to volunteer 2 to 3 hours a week. So it's a comprehensive program that provides training, but also has the students go out and help in the community with the training that they received. It's been a very popular program for them. Another thing that we saw is something called the Idea Lab. This is the Woodlawn Library Manager, Tanya Moy, who's in Colorado, talking to an expert in computers. And people who have expertise and want to share expertise will come in to this Idea Lab and work with people and show them how to use whatever technology or whatever their expertise is. So with regard to education technology programs, one of the things that libraries have started doing very early on with the internet and continue to do is to try to bring technology to those who don't necessarily know how to use it. And ways of doing this are through things like digital learning lab, distance learning, video conferencing, spaces to demonstrate new technologies, and opportunities for STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math. This is a place in Chicago where, again, students can come in and learn how to use the technology that's available to do recording. The left person on the left is Pat Birchnell. She's the manager of the New York Library, and she's in Washington, D.C. at what they call the Digital Commons. And that, what they do is they basically take new iPads and new iPhones, and, you know, we're just getting new equipment all the time, and it's impossible to stay on top of it. So what they do is they actually have models there so that people can have hands-on experience in learning these different pieces of equipment. One of the libraries in Colorado, through a grant, were able to get Google Glass very early on. So again, you know, that gives people, if you've never worn Google Glasses before, it's an interesting experience. Again, back to the idea of creating flexibility. We are going to need a large space in this library, and we're going to need flexible space. And these are some of the areas that we saw in Colorado that do that. Another area that we want to focus on is skill building. And furniture and layout is really key to that. You want to create spaces where you can do this. These are different concepts of participatory library, offering the ability to come and create. On October, the week of October 12th in Delaware, we are launching 3D printing capability. The state has provided 3D printers. Woodlawn Library is going to have one. Wilmington Library is going to have one. So what a great opportunity for kids and adults to go in and have the opportunity to create using a 3D printer. This is a space in Pikes Peak. It looks pretty empty, but again, it's flexible space, and they're able to use it to demonstrate new technology. The dinosaur was created through 3D printing. On the left-hand side, musical instruments are expensive but also popular. So some of the libraries have made, you know, small musical instruments available so that the young adults can have the opportunity to learn how to use them. And I think that was a 3D printer. That's okay. This is from Chicago. It's called the U Media Center. And it's just for teens, and it allows them to come and learn how to publish online and use new media. Some more spaces. And these are some things that we've identified that we want to look at when we actually get into the design phase for the new library. Early literacy and parenting has always been something that libraries do, and we've known that kids learn by playing. So as we design the library, we want to look at, actually we've done an excellent job at Claymont. The Claymont Library Manager reports that what's been going on in that children's room there is very exciting, and we put more, what we call, can go ahead and go to the next slide. More puppets and toys and games and Legos and things for what we call manipulatives. Creating an interesting introduction to a space is really important. Again, that's something that we did at Claymont Library with the entrance to the children's room. And then these are just more examples of inviting things for children. It's in Pennsylvania. Early literacy stations for children, and creating space where parents can sit with them, which is something that we didn't do early on. We tended to put all kid-sized furniture in the children's rooms, and then we'd see parents in there trying to sit on a kid's chair. All right. These are just examples of shared seating arrangements. Again, not what you might think of logically, very popular programs. Something that's very important, going to be really important in this project, is neighborhood economic development and partnerships. And so we really want to incorporate that into our planning. Computer training, home-based business support, and job assistance. And these are things that we saw in all the libraries that we visited. So the next slides will show some examples of that. And you can see, those are really, really popular services. These are two examples. BizBoost is a targeted local business resource that gathers clients by a public meeting, networking, and web application. And a second program is called Just For You. It's a tutor homework help service that starts with an application on the website, then schedules custom resource gathering for the client. So we're considering local business support. This is something from Chicago Public Library. We're really making an effort to support local authors.
Sure.
And this is a room that they had dedicated. You know, Chicago's a big city, so they have a lot of local authors. These are some partnerships that have been very successful at the libraries that we looked at as we visited. We're really looking increasingly at partnering with health agencies. One of the things that some libraries have done, Washington, D.C. has just done this, is bring in social workers because we have a lot of homeless people and people with some pretty pressing needs using our libraries. And these are some spaces for, that's okay. The thing on the right was some staff won a grant to kind of have an old-fashioned mobile library. So it's a bike with some book stacks on the back and a wireless, so they could ride their bike throughout the neighborhood and provide wireless access. Partnerships with 4-H are popular in certain areas, and you know, a lot of kids who live in urban environments don't get to see chickens hatch and things like that. So some of these libraries have really made an effort to bring nature into the library. Special needs that have been identified: access to social services, adult literacy, English as a second language, GED support, financial literacy, nutrition support, and services for workforce reentry. And I would share with you the story about the social workers in D.C. This is just some example of book discussions for what's called, these are adult learners. So rather than giving them an adult book, they use children's books that are easier for them to read. Partnerships with locally with groups such as the Delaware Financial Literacy Institute. Financial literacy has become very popular in libraries across this country. Assisting with people becoming citizens is also something that is a trend that we've seen. And increasingly, libraries are working to assist with reentry and also communications between those who are incarcerated and their relatives. Special collections is something that we've always done, but again, we're going to keep that in mind for this library and for other libraries. Special collections, black history, local history, literacy, multi-language collections, and travel collections. And these were some credits. So we are going to be incorporating what we saw, what we know, what's available locally, and moving forward pretty quickly on the design of this book.
Thank you very much. Councilman Smalley?
So are we pretty well have your basics or your ideas for the designs? We're done traveling. We've gathered what we need.
Well, we're almost done traveling. Sophia, do you want to?
Sophia Hansen, General Manager of Community Services. We have the last trip scheduled to the what's been determined to be the most technology advanced library in the world. We're going to Aarhus, Denmark. And
for the library?
Yeah, they actually were the partner to, you know, to Chicago Public Library.
I think we can Skype there out of Bear Library a lot cheaper. Just my opinion.
We're going to do a field visit to all the different libraries around there, but Aarhus is supposed to be the center of technology. They were award winner of the Grants Foundation Award, and which has temporarily been put on hold, but we're hoping that gets reactivated to be able to apply for that funding as well.
If you could get it to pay for the trip, I'd be a lot happier.
It's actually close in price to the stateside travel.
Quite honestly, I think there's a lot of traveling that didn't need to be done, but that's my opinion. I think we probably could have built another library somewhere. At least there wasn't no football games.
Let me just say on that point, Councilman Smalley, are you done?
Yeah, I'm done, sir. Yeah.
Because it should be known that other council members are raising concerns about the trip to Denmark. It should be no secret.
Oh, I didn't know about it.
Well, a couple of council members has mentioned to me and the number of people that are proposed to be going, which I didn't know, which I'm told is 4 people going to Denmark. So if there is, we may want to just communicate that so council will be aware before the trip is planned, so there's no hiccups after the trip is planned. People have been promised a trip because there is some buzz around who's going, how many people going, and why Denmark.
And if I can respond to that, I travel probably to Europe 3 times a year. It's not a vacation, it's a field visit. I spent my vacation time in Detroit doing field research on tackling redevelopment in our blighted areas of Newcastle County. This is a professional field visit for educational purposes. We sought out the most advanced library. We've been commuting, and it's 2 people from the Newcastle County employees that are going. And it's a lot of work. I'll be away from my children for an entire week, which puts the hardship on my husband. And this is to be taken seriously. We'll be there to work. And if anybody has any specific questions about that, I'm prepared to answer them. But it's not a vacation.
Councilman Smiley.
Well, with all due respect, I spent time away from my family on my jobs in the past, and I also do it now. Okay? I just don't think it's necessary. The Bear Library is great. The Claymont Library is great. And I don't think it needed all this extensive travel. That's my opinion. And as much as some people may not like it, I think I'm entitled to it.
No,
I'm going to have it.
You're entitled.
You know, and I applaud you if you spend your personal time doing it, because I think everybody sitting at this table uses some of their personal time when they're out somewhere to investigate things for this county. But librarians went to the others. So if the 5 days is a hardship, pick another librarian to take your place.
Well, and part of what we're doing here is we're establishing an innovation district for the entire Route 9 area. So it's a larger scope beyond that. We're creating a campus environment, and we want it to extend into other
types. I agree with that philosophy. I don't agree with the definition of the entire Route 9 area, based on what I heard. So bottom line is, good thing we don't vote on the trip.
I think it may be helpful just to identify where the cost of the trip, which budget is coming from, so council members will be aware of that, and the people that are going to make certain that
it's coming from our department, Department of Community Services, and we did cost analysis, and the cost to Chicago and the cost to Aarhus is not that much more expensive.
Yeah, I don't mean to do that right now. I want to get to the other item on the agenda.
Okay.
But going forward, I'm certain there's going to be more discussion around this issue. But I don't want to spend too much time on this trip to Denmark because we have other things to discuss.
I just have one more sarcastic comment, and that is, doesn't matter where on our books the money comes from, it comes from the people outside the walls. It's taxpayer money.
Councilman Bell.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Mr. President Pro Tem. I, for one, look at this a little bit differently as a council person, and that was my former district. It's where I grew up. It is the greater Newcastle downtown district or area, if you look at it as such. But I, for one, with my experience working with Newcastle County for 30 years and now working over Del River Bay for 16 years, that sometimes we look at traveling to other locations as insignificant or unnecessary. I have to disagree, because I think that the research, the work that this committee, that our community services manager, director of libraries, and personnel have done is giving a tremendous background. And it's no different than NACO. It's no different than International Association of Police Chiefs or national associations throughout our country, governmental agencies and organizations. But to be able to visit, to be able to network, to be able to see things firsthand, this particular project, in my mind, is going to be, when it ends up being dedicated, I think will be a model, not only for this county, but other areas. And I don't want to get into the areas much right now, but I think that any time you're embarking on a transition, a change in the way we do things, in the way we apply our library system and expanding it the way this is being presented, and I support this concept 150%, I think it is necessary for folks to go and visit. I think it is necessary for, and as was said by the general manager, is that when we looked at computer-aided dispatch, our first computer-aided dispatch system, we traveled all over this country to go and look at other systems that were up and running and learn from their mistakes. I think there's something that's gained. It's a knowledge base. It's a network that you build. You learn from others' mistakes, but you get to deal with it hands-on, firsthand. And I'm not saying that you know, a Denmark trip is warranted. However, I for one support not only this council, but our managers and employees that are in professions throughout the county to do some professional, educational type travel and training. I think that for us to be blindsided to the part that everything that we do is contained here within Newcastle County, and we're not going to gain anything but from visiting other locations, I think that that's wrong. We have folks that each year go to NACO and go to different conferences, and every time they come back, we gain from their network and their reaching out and their knowledge base. So I, for one, support what's been done to this point, and I'm going to continue to be very supportive of our community services in this initiative and our district council person.
Thank you, Councilman Bell. And we've heard two points of view on this trip to Denmark, which has taken up the last 6 or 7 minutes. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to turn this into a debate about going to Denmark or not going. I think I'm going to get to you, Councilman Street. But I want to move forward with the rest of this agenda.
But you opened the door.
And if it's a
you open the door, you start, and then you're going to shut it down before somebody else talk?
No, you're not listening to me.
No, you're not listening because you open the door, and you're just not going to turn around, open the door, and then shut it down because you don't want to hear the other side.
You're out of order, Mr. Street.
What's new about that?
Well, I'm not going to tolerate it.
And then what you going
to
do?
I'm going to get to you when I get to you. That's exactly what I'm going
to do. Well, we'll get to each other.
You can jump up and do flips and call people names and apologize.
I haven't called you anything. But if you want to reduce it to name calls, I can oblige that because you should be ashamed of yourself for sabotaging this department. Somebody had hiccups. You knew about it. Then you could have waited until, you didn't have to wait until today to raise it. You could have had the courtesy and the common decency to raise it without blindsiding folks in this department. That's and unlike Councilman Smiley, he don't throw no stone and hide his hand. He's been completely forthcoming. If other folks have concerns about it, then let them open their mouth, speak now, forever, hold their peace. But I'll be God blessed if you're going to turn around, open the door, and then close it because you don't want to hear the other side.
I'll get to you when I get to you. And you can, if you're done, I'll continue.
I'm not done.
Well, go ahead. I'll get to you now. Go ahead.
I don't need your permission.
You need my permission to get the floor in this room.
I just took it.
That is the protocol.
Well,
that is the protocol.
The protocol is common courtesy and common respect when you're dealing with employees.
That's
and for you to blindside them at the 11th hour is fundamentally unfair and flat out rotten.
For what you to try to determine who said what to me when is just your own imagination, and you're determined. To
you're the one that sat there and said you today, folks had hiccups. Who are they besides you? One person's already said what his concerns are.
Everybody around this table is not done. Everybody around this table is not going to speak to you or to me. I have a right to say what I feel like saying. You have
and
a right
so
to say
do
what
I.
You feel like saying. I'm asking you for common courtesy and decency. I recognize you as I do everyone else, and if you can't wait, then maybe I would yield. But I'm not intimidated by your nonsense.
There's nothing
nonsensical.
There's nothing nonsensical about what I'm raising with you. So
well, you
on the one, and
turn,
the same
Mr.
statement
Street,
you just
you
given,
can wait
you gave
turn,
it to
Mr.
me,
Street.
Then you take it away. You're talking out of both sides of your mouth in your argument.
We're going to move to the next item on the agenda because this is going to be nonsense. It's happening far too often in these meetings that we can't have civil discourse without a council person, unfortunately, using the same council person who's getting out of order, who's being disrespectful, and it's just really getting to be intolerable. So everybody
when you as a pro tem have the argument and you curse and you swear at Councilman Weiner, that's okay. When y'all jump up and almost go to fighting, that's okay. But when I engage in a fight about a library that I've been fighting about for 10 years with absolutely no help from you, it's all wrong. If you have a problem with that, That's just your problem.
I don't have any problems whatsoever. What I have a problem with right now is not being able to conduct this meeting in a civil manner. I've been to as many of those meetings out there as you have. I was at the one last week, made observations then. I wouldn't waste...
For 9 years running. I sat here and I did all the fighting. You never opened your mouth. He helped me. You never opened your mouth one time, and now you're going to come turn around and start sabotaging over a trip? I'm not going to accept that from you or nothing like you. And I'll die and go to hell before I'll see this library project sabotaged because all of a sudden now you want to be the important chairman.
That's your personal choice, Mr. Street. That is your personal choice. You're wasting a lot of my time and everybody else's time. And you really are. I think you need to check yourself because, quite frankly, no one is trying to stop you from talking. You make all the claims you want. This government just began when you got here 4 years, 10 years ago. Everybody knows that. Nothing happened in that community out there until you came. Everybody knows that. So if we can move forward... I'm glad you acknowledged it, not me. Right, with the comments, because everything that happened, including all of the demolitions of the things in the building in Garfield Park, all happened within the last 10 years. Everybody knows that. If we may move forward, my point is that there's not going to be a long, elongated debate about this trip. If it's about the finances, then it should be discussed in a finance committee meeting. This meeting is not designed to discuss and have a elongated debate about this trip to Denmark or any other trip for that matter. That's my point. So we've had opposing views about the trip, and we may have more views about the trip. I'm not here to debate the trip, and I'm not going to spend the rest of the time today talking about the trip to Denmark. And that is my point, and that's my prerogative as chair. And any other council person can feel the way they want and argue about what they want, when they want. It's just not going to happen at this hour. Councilman Street, if you have anything further to say, you're recognized to say that.
I mean, all I have to say, other than the fact that...
Councilman Powers?
Yes, I've been present for this presentation.
I'm sorry?
I've been present.
I'm sorry. You want to be noticed as being present. All right. The other point I wanted to make, I was at the meeting last week, and for God's sake, I'm not certainly not trying to take the blame or the ownership of this innovation center. It's not my district. I happen to go to the meetings. I am one of the co-chairs of community services. Most libraries are regularly operated by the community services division. That's pretty the standard here in Newcastle County. It's no different for Route 9 Library. What I want to mention is that the Innovation Center has been proposed to be called, as well as the library. The partnerships that are involved there, those partners are also invited to the table at these library meetings. At the last one on last week, there was a superintendent of the Colonial School District to help develop with Newcastle County in this particular area. Educational component that would fit with the Colonial School Board, as well as the Nemours Foundation had a representative there to come forward to partner with on healthcare issues, primarily as it relates to the youth. So there are active partnerships going on that they're invited to the table to be a part of this discussion as we go forward. It's owned by primarily the funding is from Newcastle County, I think, so far, but there's an opportunity with discussions with the DuPont Company and others to make certain that there's other finances brought to bear to this, including the designation that the general manager spoke to at the meeting last week to get the state of Delaware to declare it, designation that would also enable us to get even more resources to come to that particular area. Are there any other further comments or questions regarding the first presentation? Councilman Street.
I have sent to all members of council notification that the department is making an application to the state of Delaware to include the area around the library as a downtown development district. I hope to have that legislation finalized for presentation at our next meeting, and the only thing we have not come to a final conclusion is the complete definition of the area, and that's consistent with the concerns raised by Councilman Smiley, and as to whether or not we're going to determine some actual boundaries or not in making the proposal and the request to the state.
Councilwoman Diller.
I just want to say I do have concerns, but Ms. Hansen, I'll just email you. How about that? And we'll move forward, okay?
Fine.
Thank you.
And I want any council person to know that if you have a concern, when you see me, normally we see each other on Tuesdays, and you relate those concerns to me, I will move forward to try to get a resolution to it, and I will speak to those issues, even if it's in a meeting. I'm not trying to blindside the general manager or any other person here. Just the fact of the matter is, when I was noticed today with the concerns, as a matter of fact, my aide had taken the note here when I sat down at this table this afternoon to say that council members had raised a question about this trip. I didn't even know it was four people going on the trip, as a matter of fact, until I read this. But I want to rest this right now.
It's two people going on the trip. And if I could just add one other caveat. I'm actually going to Boston for two vacation personal days to meet with a board member of the Kresge Foundation, 100% paid by me, to try to bring funding for the Route 9 Library or for the Downtown Development District. So I just would like to add that as well.
And that's fine. There's a lot of dialogue back and forth. As I just sent you an email this morning, as someone in the neighborhood who had sent me an email about what people are hearing about different things that are happening.
About the library transition.
Right, and that's how this stuff comes to fruition, and we tried to find answers to it. But I don't think it's necessary for myself or any other member of council to disrespect any other member of council or any member of the public or anyone from the administration to get their point across. We will continue to have differences, and that's what's expected here. If everybody had the same opinion, then maybe 12 people could go home. If we move forward now to the next presentation, Councilman Street.
I just want to clarify for the record. There's been, number one, the county executive made it clear from the inception when he decided to expand the library. And this is what he said in the meeting last week, that it was going to be the best in the world the day it was open. And he wanted to travel and see to it that folks looked at what was supposed to be the best libraries in the country and the world. Second, it was well known, and it was made crystal clear in the presentation last week at the government center. It's been in writing that the trip was planned, and so to use the term blindside wasn't mentioned last week, not mentioned to the day, I think was fundamentally unfair. And that's my view of it. As you said, you had your opinion of it. I have mine, and obviously they don't comport at this time. And my question is an issue of fairness in dealing with the department and our employees.
We'll move to the next presentation. Stephanie Rizzo is going to report. This is the annual report on workforce housing, which is required by code. Also, I would note that Jason Etcher is here. He's the builder, as most of you know, down in Bayberry. It's one of the workforce housing sites, which I think it's not correct to call it a workforce housing site. It is a site that includes 39 housing workforce housing opportunities because of the expansion from the original proposal. It's over 900 dwelling units being planned there, and over 900, only 39 of those units are in fact workforce. But I think with my visit there, along with the general manager of Community Services, we were both very impressed with what we saw at the Bayberry development. And Stephanie Rizzo is going to give an overall review, and near the end of the presentation there will be a focus on workforce housing. And if there's any questions regarding the program, at least we have someone here today that's actually involved with the development of the housing and actually preparing and proposing and have tenants living in the Bayberry community. So with that, I yield to Ms. Rizzo.
Hello, thank you everyone. So if you guys have any questions about workforce housing, if you get any calls or, you know, constituents contacting you, you can contact me directly. And I also wanted to introduce a new employee that's working with workforce housing. Her name is Shanae Irby, and she's with the Public Allies program, so she's kind of like an intern with AmeriCorps, so we're happy to have her. This is just going to be the annual report to County Council, so it's basically for the fiscal year 2014, what's been going on with the workforce housing program. Everyone should have received this. Is the annual report, and it goes into more detail. It has the actual annual monitoring reports for each of the developments we visited. If anyone doesn't have a copy or would like one, I had to have. But those, basically, these are the notable workforce housing actions that have happened during fiscal year 2014. I started working with the Workforce Housing Program in December of 2013 when I was in the Community Governing Office, and they kind of had us take over, and Community Governing has been disbanded, but I've had the pleasure of still being in charge of the program. So, most notable action was the moratorium that was put in place, and basically this ceased all any new plans coming in for the workforce housing, but it also allowed the current workforce housing plans to continue through the process. Prior to the passage of the moratorium, the Department of Land Use did notify engineers and developers about the pending legislation. And as you may know, we had five submittals for the workforce housing plans prior to the moratorium. But talking to the Department of Law, it was determined that all five of those submissions were going to be rejected by the Department of Land Use. So they received their rejection letters, and they will not go forward under the workforce housing previous ordinance. This basically is a pie chart showing all the applications that we've received and where they're located. So you can see Delaware is receiving the majority of the workforce housing. You know, we have Pennsylvania, even as far as Oregon and Illinois. And then other, we actually have two foreign, you know, applicants, I think Saudi Arabia and China. The next is our income, applicant income. This is for all of the workforce housing developments. So you see that the majority of them are moderate income, which is 120% of the area median income through HUD. And then there's low and very low. And then the purple are people that income qualified, but they never followed through, or maybe they made too much money and they did not qualify. So I think we had about 63 applications for fiscal year 2014. And just to give you an idea as to what income is to be considered low, moderate, or very low, this is the income chart from HUD. It's updated every December, so it will be changed annually. Another breakdown that we thought we should do is to show the occupations that we've been receiving applications for, and these are all people that have received the workforce housing opportunity. There's a majority of them that you see that are in banking. We've also had a lot of students. Those students mostly took advantage of the rentals in the Reserve FX Pond. A lot of the very low income portion that you saw on the previous chart was mostly the students, because they don't, basically their parents are the ones who are paying for their units, but their income is low, very low. And so we've also had a few retired people take advantage of it. So the annual monitoring, we sent out letters in December of 2013 to schedule the monitoring visits, and most of them took place in January and February of 2014. At the time, there were five current developments that were accepting application, and that's the five that you see there: Bayberry North, Goldsboro Farms, Merrow Landing, Reserve FX Pond, and Darley Green. This year, we do have two more developments that are finally starting to build, and that's going to be, so you'll see High Hook Farms and Preserve at Robinson Farm next year. And then, just to go through each one individually, I'm going alphabetical order. So Bayberry North is the first one. Again, more detail in the annual monitoring report is included in the annual report you received. But according to the agreement with Bayberry North, they're able to offer rentals and or for sale units on site or off site to moderate income households. So currently, they are offering on-site rentals. There are 949 houses planned totally in Bayberry North. It is an open space plan, so there's 176 acres of open space. And there's 39 workforce housing units. So what that is, if I remember correctly, and luckily she's here, I think the plan was originally submitted for like 750 units, and then they revised the plan to incorporate workforce housing, so they got an additional like 200 units, and that's why there's 39 workforce housing units. So they've actually broken them down. Four will be single family detached with a two car garage, 13 are the two story attached with one car alley garage, and then there's 22 three story attached with a one car garage. And Bayberry North also has, like, you know, future town center, retail, office space, and recreational amenities. So the first house we're going to look over is the single family detached house. That's an actual workforce unit. It's approximately 2,100 square feet. It has four bedrooms, 2.5 baths, two-car garage, has main floor laundry, and the appliances are included. It's currently renting for $1,900 a month. And the maximum affordable rent per the Newcastle County Code for a moderate income family, I think because it's a four bedroom house, they could charge up to $2,150 per month. For the Bayberry North two story attached house, again, three bedrooms, 2.5 baths, one car garage, second floor laundry, appliances included, 1,800 square feet, it's renting for $1,500 a month. And according to the maximum affordable rent chart for Newcastle County Code, they could charge up to $2,020 per month. And then that's a picture of a three-story attached house, approximately 1,800 square feet, three bedrooms, 2.5 baths, one car garage, appliances also included. It's currently renting for $1,350 per month. And again, because it's a three-bedroom, the maximum affordable rent for Newcastle County is $2,020 a month. The current status of housing for Bayberry North, there's currently 8 units that are occupied. 2 are the single-family detached, 2 are the two-story attached, and 4 are the three-story attached. There's currently 2 that are on the market available for rent right now, and there should be 2 becoming available soon. They're under construction. So then that takes us to Goldsboro Farm, which is located in Townsend on Fieldsboro Road. And according to their agreement, they can offer rentals and for sale units on site to low or moderate income households. Currently, they're offering on site for sale units. There's 143 total homes, and 13 of those are workforce housing units. So just to give you an example of a workforce housing unit, that's the Florence model. You know, fair price market rate are the low $260,000. Three bedrooms, two baths, but you know, can add onto bedrooms and bathrooms. The maximum allowable sales price for a three-bedroom per Newcastle County Code for low income is $224,800. For moderate income, it's $360,400. Goldsboro Farm, the current status of housing, 2 units actually sold last fiscal year to moderate income households, and they've already completed their first year of ownership. So I've already sent out their annual monitoring letter, and they've already sent back a copy of their ID and their homeowner's insurance and their utility bills to prove that they still live there. We have 2 units that have been approved, and they're just currently awaiting for closing, which is supposed to occur in January 2015. And per their staging plan, 7 of the 13 units must be sold to low-income households. So next is Mara Landing. That's located in Wilmington on Newport Gap Pike. And according to that agreement, Mara Landing can offer rentals and for sale units on-site to low or moderate-income households. Currently, they're offering on-site rental units. All of the units have been rented, and the neighborhood is completely already filled out. So they have 27 homes were planned in the development, and 6 of those units are workforce housing. This is an example of a workforce housing unit. It's approximately 2,000 square feet, three bedrooms, two baths, one car garage. It's currently renting for $1,850 a month. However, the maximum affordable rent per Newcastle County is $1,210 per month and $2,000 per month if you're moderate income. So the people that qualified as low income, they weren't renting for $1,850. They would rent for the $1,210 at that time. So the current status of the housing from Mirror Landing, all six of the units are rented. Per the staging plan, three of the units must be rented to... Yes?
Who makes up the difference? Back on the last slide. When it's 1210, who pays?
Basically, the developer cannot rent a unit to a low-income household for more than 12.
So they have to rent it for 12. Mm-hmm.
Honestly, I can actually tell you one of the tenants that is considered low-income is an employee of Mr. Mara, so he cut him a really good deal. I want to say he may even be renting it for $500 a month. But there's three of the units must be
job openings.
three units must be rented to low income households, and three must be rented to moderate income. And this is one of the plans that I haven't seen this on any other plans. Specific units are actually identified as to whether they're to be low income or moderate income. So then that takes us to the reserve effects pond. According to their agreement, they are located in Newark. They're on Salem Church Road. It's an apartment complex, which is one of the only ones that I've seen so far completely as an apartment complex. But they can offer rental units on site to lower moderate income households. They have 240 total units, and 48 of them are workforce housing. So this is just an example of a one-bedroom unit. It's approximately 129 square feet, one bedroom, one bath. It's got stackable laundry, appliances included, a portion of balcony. The market rate for anyone who just walked in off the street, they would pay $1,130 per month. So the maximum affordable rent for Newcastle County is $1,150 per month if you're low income, and $1,780 per month if you're moderate income. So that's just to show you that the market rate is already less than the low income amount. Two bedroom unit, 1,082 square feet, two bedrooms, two baths, laundry, appliances, balcony. The market rate is $1,280 per month, and the maximum affordable rent for Newcastle County is $1,270 per month for low income and $1,980 for moderate income. The three bedroom unit, 1,300 square feet, three bedrooms, two baths, laundry, balcony. Their market rate is $1,495 per month, and for low income, per Newcastle County chart, $1,400 per month for low and $2,190 per month for moderate. So the current status of the housing at the Reserve Effects Pond, all 48 units are rented. All of the buildings are complete. Per the staging plan, you can see what's required, that each building is supposed to have, five or four. So five low, five moderate for building 100. They currently have five low and six moderate. 200, five low, four moderate, they have exactly that. Building 300, five low, five moderate, they have five low, six moderate. Building 400, five low, five moderate, they have seven low, five moderate. Building 500, four low, five moderate, four low, seven moderate. So that helps having more, because if a tenant moves out that's a workforce housing applicant, another one can't move in unless they're income qualified. So if they have that little cushion there, it allows for an easier transition. Lastly, I have Darley Green, which is not really under the workforce housing ordinance, so they have kind of different terms to their agreement. But according to their agreement, Darley Green can offer workforce housing units on-site with 67% to be home ownership and off-site rental or for sale units. There's a total of 1,226 units, and 130 of those are to be workforce housing units. Here's an example of a Darley Green workforce housing unit, the Chesterfield model. It's approximately 2,500 square feet, three bedrooms, 2.5 baths, one car garage. Market rate is $235,000. Current status of housing in Darley Green. Darley Green is well within the guidelines for their, according to their agreement, because it says prior to the issuance of the 450th building permit, 45 workforce units shall have obtained building permits. Currently, there's only 145 building permits that have been issued for Darley Green. I have not received any applicants or qualified anyone for income in Darley Green.
Mr. Chairman, if I could just comment on the Darley Green situation. This project is unique in that there is a workforce housing agreement that binds to the site. And this was done prior to the adoption of the workforce housing ordinance that we now have under moratorium. And this agreement reflects the requirements for workforce housing, given the very large density bonuses that were realized on the project due to its inclusion in the hometown overlay zone in Claymont, and also due to the fact that in the master planning, we wanted to make a walkable and transit-oriented community that is proximate to the Claymont train station, which is the largest commuter rail station apart from Wilmington in the state of Delaware in terms of ridership. So there's some unique features here. And of course, the project went through the worst of the real estate recession, and now just emerging from that under new ownership after foreclosure. But we're looking forward to the production of these units as the project begins to gain momentum.
Thank you, Councilor.
And that's it. I'm done with the presentation if anyone has any questions.
Thank you very much. I think that you did a good job on that presentation. And I think if council members have not seen the full report, again, I believe that Stephanie did an excellent job in compiling this report. It's more extensive than what we saw here today. Councilwoman Kilpatrick.
Thank you. Stephanie, I just have one question. Mm-hmm. You, throughout here, the presentation, you talked about each individual agreement. Mm-hmm. Those that have rentals, my assumption is that they were in the program before the rentals were taken out. Mm-hmm. Is that correct? So there's no special agreement for anybody having rentals after the amended version. Okay, correct. Thank you.
Any further comment, questions? Councilman Street.
Well, it appears to me that based on the presentation, which was excellent, and based on what I have not read thoroughly but perused, I'm glad we had a moratorium on, because the designated purpose and intention has not come to fruition. When you look at costs between $1,000 and $2,000, and the primary occupants at this point being renters, then what we intended in terms of home ownership and affordable housing, and I've raised it before the presentation, affordable for who? And to the extent that it's crystal clear to me from the presentation of what I've looked at in the documents, that it's not achieving its designated purpose. And I think the primary beneficiaries are not folks who want to be first-time home buyers, not folks who are low and moderate income, but the developers. That wasn't the purpose and intention. And until that changes and until we come up with some new formulas, I, for one, think the moratorium should stay in place.
Any additional comment from members of council regarding the workforce? Councilwoman Kilpatrick?
Just to add to what Councilman Street said, are we going to have a presentation at one of these meetings on where we're going with the new workforce housing or whatever designation we're putting on? I mean, we put on a moratorium so that we could move forward and change, because obviously I, being one of them, thought that there were problems with the one that was in existence. But it's been several months now, and we have not heard anything about where this is going as far as bringing anything forward.
Yes, we will. We have, as I mentioned before, when I did the second extension of the moratorium, well, the first extension of the moratorium, you will have before you the first meeting in October. We introduced the second extension of the moratorium, which would take us into December or January. And we had to send it back to land use. Land use should have it back to us by the first meeting of October. We would vote for the second extension. The reason why we continue to have these extensions is simply because we cannot get the work to start on time that we had hoped for. We were working with national consultants. I just met with the general manager of land use last week to look over the report that we have received now, that we just received from the consultants. We have three consultants working with us. The land use attorney, Mary Jacobson, who's not in the room, was at that meeting along with Ken Berry, one of our principal planners, and they are now working on the language as Eileen and I are going through this document. We will call together a meeting of the task force that has been meeting, as has been a task force for the library out on Route 9. We've had three meetings with the task force, which represents a number of stakeholders, including developers, people that are in the market, that are nonprofits, et cetera, real estate people. And we plan to have another meeting with the task force after the legislation is prepared. The legislation should come before council, as I mentioned, for the first meeting in October to be introduced, and then obviously we will have discussions at council at that time. And the idea is to make certain that we have a dual piece of legislation to repeal the workforce housing as we know it as soon as we adopt the new legislation. But we have to do all of this because the moratorium is only going to be extended until, I forget the exact date, sometime late December, early January. So we don't have a whole lot of time, but we have roughly, from the time we introduce it next month in our first meeting, just to begin these discussions about where we're going to go. And we plan to have the consultants come in to meet with the task force as soon as we introduce it to council during the first meeting of October.
So from what you're saying, all of the existing workforce will be brought under the new workforce law? There will, all of their criteria out there will change, or that's all grandfathered in and stays as it is?
No, the application that we are dealing with now that are in the workforce housing legislation will be governed by workforce housing legislation. Going forward, there will be no workforce housing legislation if we adopt the moderate price dwelling units legislation, which is a proposed name going forward. So there will be no workforce housing legislation. One of the key features of the new proposal would be that it would be far less density to include affordable units or moderately priced units. So there would be some fundamental changes in the legislation. It'll be a different piece of legislation, as a matter of fact. So it's not trying to repair the workforce housing legislation or to fix workforce housing legislation. It is to replace the workforce housing legislation with a new piece of legislation and repeal the workforce housing legislation once the new legislation is adopted.
So all those workforce housing units standing now
are governed by the workforce housing legislation.
But once you repeal that, they are no longer...
But their applications are already in, so they're still moving forward under that program.
All right, well, I guess we have to discuss this more because I don't know what happens to those people like living in workforce housing units now. What governs them?
The legislation that was in effect when they moved into the house, that would not change. It has
So that's not the repeal, part of the repeal.
The legislation is repealed, not the existing people that are living in the houses now. It doesn't repeal the contract that you have. People that are living in Bayberry now would not be impacted by the new legislation.
Okay, I have.
The legislation is not retroactive. The new legislation is not a retroactive piece of legislation. It would govern going forward the moderately priced dwelling units will replace workforce housing.
Right. Okay, I just misunderstood what you said.
Okay, I'm sorry.
Okay,
Councilman.
Ben, to your point, because we have two separate programs, it creates increased staffing demands. My confidential assistant currently runs the workforce housing program under the existing program. So when you have new units coming in that are monitored under a whole different set of regulations, so it has some impact. So that'll be something we consider going forward with our department's budget.
Right, that would be part of the budget discussion. And the part we didn't mention is the fact that even with Bayberry, the amount of money that is going to be going to the housing trust fund as a result of all of the building that's taking place in Bayberry, not just workforce housing, but the whole 949 units are paying into the Newcastle mm-hmm. County Trust Fund. So that means there's a pool of money there that can help offset the administration of these programs, which will in fact require more man hours to do. Councilman Weiner, Bell Street.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You got my attention when you talked about less of a footprint of the building. One of the things that I've learned through chairing the Smart Growth Committee in NACO is successful models across the country trade off bigger lots for better architectural design, architectural excellence, and quality of construction materials. And I know if you're working with our general manager, she well understands that, and so I look forward to seeing what comes forward.
Thank you very much. Yeah. Councilman Bell?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just bring up this point again, and I've mentioned it in the past, and when we look at this presentation for the projects, whether you look at Goldsboro Farm, you look at Robinson Farm, you look at High Hook, you look at Bayberry, or in the 12th District, and only one of those projects, only one, and that be Bayberry, represents a well-thought-out, planned, supportive infrastructure. And I don't say it because Jason Etch is here, I say it because it was on that slide. And what I mean by that is walkable, bikeable, transit-oriented, friendly, shopping, schools in close proximity, a plan for the future to support folks that unlike the other three we allow on two-lane rural roads that still to this day do not conform with DLDOT standards, do not have sidewalks, are not lit, there is no transit, and there is no shopping, gasoline, anything in any type of walkable, bikeable, transit type systems. When I look at the numbers and I look at things, sometimes I wonder if the bonuses that we gave to the developers may have been a service to them, but I'm not quite sure that it's not a disservice to who we were really trying to reach out to and have affordable housing for. And I think we've got a lot of homework to do in a short period of time, but I can tell you that we've got to focus on having infrastructure, and Bayberry will have a playground. Bayberry will have a pool. The other three won't. One backs up to a area along Joyers Creek and Marsh area that floods all the time. There's no playgrounds. There's no nothing for our youth to go to and everything else. And so I think we've got work to do. And like I say, maybe a service to who built them, and maybe a little bit of disservice to who we're trying to get housed and offer affordable housing. But I certainly hope we take a better look at infrastructure, in the future.
To that point, Councilman Bell, I think what you would see going forward is that these dwelling units will be tied directly to rezonings. So all the issues with infrastructure that you're concerned about, the council members are concerned about, will be tied directly to the rezoning. There will be one facet of the new legislation, and then that would be a volunteer piece of it that people can take a lead, but that would not be the types of bonus incentives that we've seen in the past with workforce housing. Councilman Street.
Thank you.
Well, to follow up on what Councilman Bell was saying, and if you hold Bayberry out as a good example, my recollection of the presentation was just made right now, workforce housing is limited to rental property. So I go, and what they're doing now is offering rentals. And rentals between $1,000 and $2,000. It goes back to the point I made originally. My understanding, which was limited because all y'all that have all this expertise in land use and housing, I gave deference to your judgment, was that it was to create home ownership, provide housing for folks low and moderate income. And I don't see where that's come to fruition. And now what's being said is we this, we that, and I don't know who we is, and I'd be interested to know in who we is, who's now going to be a part of developing this formula, because I want to know if the we includes representation from those who are the intended beneficiaries. And I think that may be a part of the challenge, failure to include those who we intend to benefit in the decision-making process may be part of the reason that, in my opinion, we fall short thus far in this process.
To your concern, Councilman Street, the we is Newcastle County, and anyone who's interested who would like to be a part of this process, as it was with the first time around with workforce housing. It's not two or three people sitting in a room. The task force that we've accumulated for this time around, as I mentioned earlier, includes a wide variety of people, including people from West End Neighborhood House in the city of Wilmington, including the Delaware Coalition for Housing, people that are advocates for moderately priced housing, including Kevin Kelly, who's on the national board for affordability, as well as any others. I've mentioned to council before that these task force meetings are taking place. We cannot develop a product with 30 people around the table, so we've acquired the knowledge of national consultants that are working in other jurisdictions around this country. As more and more jurisdictions are concerned about affordability, they are working with our land use general manager as one of the people that has been the sponsor of the previous affordability legislation and plan to go forward with the next piece. It's not unusual for the council member that's going to sponsor the legislation to work directly with the department, and then it's up to the county council to make the final determination as to what they like or don't like about the product. But any council person is certainly welcome to any of those meetings. None of these meetings are private. We have people from the real estate community, I believe I mentioned, Ms. Scott, who also serves on one of our boards here that we interviewed, I guess, 6 weeks ago. She's also the president of the Newcastle County Board of Realtors. So folk that are interested are welcome to come, but it's not a mandatory meeting, but at the same time, it's not a closed meeting. We realize that there were concerns raised with the workforce housing legislation. We're not reaching the poorest of the poor. People who are in homes actually have to meet the same criteria, whether they're workforce housing or not. They still have to go to the bank to get approval. What happened in the case of Bayberry, the legislation at that time allowed for rentals to be there. The legislation was amended to take rentals out. What we all know now is that there's a very shortage of rentals in Newcastle County, even going from the presentation we had in the Finance Committee meeting, when we realized there was only one application for multi-dwelling family units in Newcastle County, which is a national trend across this country, and that's where most jurisdictions are trying to find ways to actually attract folk who are in lower incomes. And one of the ways we plan to do that in Newcastle County is with the Housing Trust Fund that I believe from Bayberry alone would have close to $250,000 in trust fund dollars that would go to supplement interfaith housing and groups like that that are providing housing for lower income folk, primarily in the area of, I believe, your district, quite frankly, where most of interfaith work has taken place with the combination of community development block grant funds. But those people are not forgotten. They're just harder to get enough resources to make certain that they're included, no different than it is with Section 8 and every other program we have. There's four more applications than we have actual resources. Councilwoman Kilpatrick and Councilman Street.
Thank you. And I have to agree with Councilman Street that I don't think that this program, and I was not on this council at that time, but I don't think that the program did what it was intended to do, which is, I thought, to put people in homes that they actually had some ownership of. And I can tell you, the one in my district, the reason that they're doing rentals and the developer did not want to do rentals is because he couldn't sell the units because of the price point that it costs to build them. And I, in looking at, you know, some of the prices that we saw quoted in this presentation, there are very few people that have limited income that I feel could afford even the rental units of some of these. So I totally agree with you. My other question would be, if we come up with this new program, mm-hmm. could those that now are under workforce housing withdraw that from workforce housing and reapply under the new program?
You mean an applicant?
A developer.
A developer. Yes, of course. A developer, when we started the program, a number of developers pulled out of workforce housing. As a matter of fact, we'll be voting next month on one that pulled out in your district
right.
that's going for a rezoning.
Right.
So you still have that right to pull out at any time, as most of them did. A handful went forward, but the ones that you're talking about, actually the ones that have the rental units, are the ones that applied and stayed in the program before we did the amendment to the program. When you look at the price points are not set by Newcastle County government or by county council. The price points are HUD numbers, and we're in the Philadelphia market. It's one of the things that we've been challenged with right now, because you look at the HUD pricing that you've seen presented by the Department of Community Services are not numbers that came from the Department of Community Services. Right. We're getting most of our monies from HUD. Every consultant in this country is going to use HUD numbers. What we're trying to wrestle with now with the new program is to be more realistic. What are the numbers here in Newcastle County? And that, well, once we do that, we still have to use HUD numbers. There's no one in this country who's going to say the number, that's a consultant in America who's going to say, well, the numbers in Newcastle County are this and HUD numbers are that. They're going to give you HUD numbers. So that's what you're looking at. HUD is saying in this market, this is the max what you can charge for a moderately priced house. This is the max of what you charge for a low-priced apartment. Those are HUD numbers. These are not our numbers.
I'm not sure that they're workable numbers when we talk about...
And that's what we're trying to look at going right. forward, that will this work here in Newcastle County? Because what the people will tell you in the meetings that I've attended, Stephanie will say, anybody around this table will say, well, $1,600 is still a lot of money, including me. But the fact of the matter is, it's based upon these HUD numbers, and how do we change that and make certain we're still compliant and still getting HUD dollars? So we can rent to lower, and there are lower, and I mentioned some of those folks that are providing lower housing, even for ownership, such as West End, who's been at all of our meetings trying to help us through some of the questions that you even have about the period for residency, which West End claims works very fine. Which you talk to someone in our department, like a Carrie Casey, who's working directly with our consultants as well, because of her knowledge and history of NSP and how those programs work and what's required for voting. So all of these things, we have a lot of people that are experts, and once we bring it here, people can bring their political flavor to it, and we end up negotiating and doing other kinds of things. But it certainly wasn't a perfect piece that we adopted, and I doubt if this is going to be a perfect piece that's going to be presented. But there are people working on it to make it the best we can to try to reach those people that I think we all feel that we need to reach. But you still have people around this table who would tell you that we should not include rentals. That's the reality of it. Rentals is in the legislation. That's the greatest need. But we may not get 7 votes for rentals. We take rentals out as we did before. And that's the end of the day, or you end up with a political product that you're able to get enough people to support. And I can tell you that with the first piece of legislation, the reason why some of the amendments occurred was because of people in the Delaware General Assembly who stood right across the table from me and asked me, why do you have rentals?
I remember.
Right, and that's the reality of it. So we're working as hard as we can to get a good product. At the end of the day, everybody around this table get an opportunity to make amendments, vote it up, vote it down, and then we go home. Councilman Street, I'm sorry.
Well, you know, I had occasion and worked with Mr. Calistro in his housing issues all the time. But the people that come to Hilltop, the people that I refer, more often than not are single parents, working full time, making less than $50,000 a year. And that program enables them to be first time home buyers, and they do an excellent job. But when we're talking about $1,900 and $1,600, you just disqualified the predominance of people that come to community centers like mine and want to buy homes. And I hate to make this analogy, but to me, it's absolutely the same. In Sunday's paper, I had an editorial about school discipline and said that in order to resolve a problem, you have to first acknowledge that you have a problem. Our failure in the instant matter to acknowledge that we have a problem and that this isn't working destines us to do the same thing the same way, and again, the intended beneficiaries will fail to benefit. And if it comes forward like that, I will vigorously and adamantly oppose it, because what I thought was the purpose and intention of it, the spirit and intention of it, is obviously not being achieved, and in my opinion, at this point, really not being thought about in a serious way. When what has been put before us is like it's business as usual, and HUD sets the numbers, and we have to adhere to HUD. Well, HUD said this is what the maximum could be. HUD's not going to prohibit you from renting a property or selling a property that costs $500 a month. It says what the maximum could be. It doesn't say what the least amount could be. And if these developers can come forward with these projects and these alternatives and leave latitude to make sure that the people that I know put me in office are concerned about, then I'm going to have problems supporting it and will adamantly oppose it if they are not included in the intended benefit in the beneficiaries at the end of the day.
What's going to happen, if I can respond briefly, is that the moderate price dwelling units would not be an opportunity for everybody. I want to make that very clear. The idea is to work with the development community and make certain there's enough incentives so the developers are also going to make a profit. And the developers are not in the development business as beneficiaries to any group of the population. It's all about the economy around all of this. So what we're trying to do is find a program where the people that are building the houses will actually see a benefit to include folk that who otherwise may not live in these developments. There's another program that people get confused with called Section 8 that helps people at another strata of the economy. What a lot of people who don't like workforce housing simply because they confuse it with Section 8. The workforce housing legislation, the moderately priced dwelling units, whatever we're going to call it, is not a Section 8 program. So I recognize that everybody won't benefit. Everybody's not going to be a homeowner. The idea is to make housing less than what the market rate is to include additional people. The housing strategy that we adopted in Newcastle County some years ago is not just about workforce housing and not just about the moderate price dwelling units. It's also about helping people move from Section 8 to home ownership. It's also about the program that we adopted through various neighborhoods throughout this county for stabilization. It's all about NSP. All of those things make up the affordable housing program. So to assume that the legislation that's going to replace the workforce housing program is going to make it affordable to everybody is just not realistic. The option to that would be for Newcastle County to start building houses and renting them at $500 a month or $400 a month or whatever this county deems necessary. But when you're working with developers and you're looking at the cost to provide the unit, you have to build into that at least an opportunity to make money and provide the units. And that's what we're trying to do with the program.
Since that was in response to my concerns, let me say this in closing. Okay. Anybody that's working with somebody in a so-called housing program and they can afford $1,600 and $1,900 to rent, anybody who's counseling them and is not giving them latitude in a way to be homeowners
they need to go out of the business.
Thank you. Councilman Powers?
Yeah, when you were saying with Hood, you know, in the county, there's one thing that's totally different from the canal south, and Jay would know that, is rural development-backed loans only go to $250,000, and they are only offered from the canal south.
Excuse me, can somebody answer their phone? Okay, it just went off. I'm sorry.
So, I mean, that does play into it if you look at a lot of the houses that are selling now. Now, also, on the workforce housing, I mean, there was a major mistake. Major. On Fieldsboro Road. And right now, even where Jay's is, there's no, none of them are 5 miles from any grocery store. The closest store that would have any groceries on Fieldsboro is Willie's Farm Market. The drugstore is in Towns End, 5 miles. So, you know, we brought it up when they were coming up that you shouldn't be doing this. And if you have Fieldsboro Road S and the next road over is SR, there is not going to be anything there in the near future. But what I'm saying it for is that was a mistake in the legislation to begin with. None of us thought that it would be put on the most furthest most out, not near anything. And he's right. Fieldsboro Road, High Hook, they're going to have to walk 3 miles to get to a Happy Harry's maybe, and they got to cross Route 1 to get to it.
Yeah, and all this legislation will come before council for a vote, as did Bayberry. Bayberry did not come before council as a workforce housing development.
Bayberry would have even further to go to water,
right?
Because there's nothing there right now.
Exactly, and that's what's happening across Newcastle County in the growth area. But we will all have an opportunity to vote, and it would be tied to rezonings. But Bayberry has over 900 houses, and only 39 of those 900 homes is a workforce unit. So the issue with Bayberry is not one of workforce housing or affordability. It could be a number of other things, but it's not workforce housing. Did you want to speak, Jay, before we end this particular session here?
I know it's late, and I'll make it brief. The workforce housing legislation was done at the height of the housing market. So the home prices were a lot higher. And one of the intentions of the program was to provide smaller, more affordable, lower income homes. And in that objective, the program has succeeded beyond anybody's belief. At Bayberry, we had no homes that could have sold below $300,000. And under the workforce program, we were able to introduce 195 more houses, all but 19 of which are below $250,000. And of the 195 homes that we were able to add, 155 are under home ownership. So the workforce housing program provided benefits to us. I'll be the first one to admit that. And that's the whole basis of incentive-based legislation. It should help the general public. It should help the developers. That's what the idea of incentive is. But the program has provided 155 homes below $250,000 in prices to home buying public. So to that extent, the program is successful. The reason why the 39 homes that are designated workforce have not sold is because the market conditions have changed. And people have opted to buy homes that had no resale restrictions, that they did not have to share a portion of their profits with the government, and therefore people have opted to rent them. Now, who is renting these? People who could not otherwise buy them. We have people that have had homes foreclosed, people who have poor credit, people who don't have long enough employment history. So these 39 homes, if we get away from the idea that rental is bad, they're doing a good service to people who could not otherwise buy. So they're able to live in a nice community, albeit at higher rental prices. But what we also work with them to do is help them correct their credit, improve their credit scores, so the tenancy is an interim step on their way to home ownership. On the matter of contribution to the government trust fund, we have to date contributed $225,000 to the housing trust fund. By the time the project is completed, we will have contributed close to $1 million to housing trust fund. So what is with any other piece of legislation, either at its formation or with the evolution of conditions, it becomes imperfect. But it has certainly provided benefits, not just to us, but to the larger community. And I'm not arguing for or against it. I'm just observing what may not be immediately clear.
Thank you very much. Councilman Street.
And given what you just said, and I would argue, but I don't want to argue with you, that when we do a credit check and somebody's eligible to pay $1,600, $1,900 rent, they're eventually, if not then, going to be eminently qualified to buy a home. So my suggestion is that as you continue down that road, maybe one of the things that you want to consider is rent to own in terms of an option, to actually have those people who can pay $1,600 a month be able to eventually own a home if they choose to do so.
Right. And that is the whole idea, is to credit counsel them and help them improve their credit so they can buy either the home they're living in or the home within or outside the community. So, and this is not to argue about anything. This is more to put ideas on the table from the perspective of someone who has benefited and attempted to benefit the society as well.
Thank you for coming. Any other comment? Any comment from the public? A long meeting. I thank you very much for your attention. And I want, before we adjourn, I want to sincerely apologize to all of you for the lack of professional conduct during the meetings. Thank you all very much.
Motion to adjourn.
Second.